Hi, everybody. Welcome into another episode of the Comics Experience Make Comics podcast, a show where we talk about the nuts and bolts of making comics. And this episode, we're going to be talking about work for hire. And that is going to be with one Mr. Paul Aller.
Paul, hello.
Paul, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I'm going to talk like this the entire time. Is that okay?
As long as you can sustain it.
No, we're good.
The thing that I've learned from reading children's books out loud to my daughter is your main voice has to kind of be your voice, because otherwise it gets messy.
That does make sense, yes.
Yeah, and also, a five-year-old does not know that you're doing a terrible Johnny Carson impression. It happens very frequently, and there's
some weird, wild stuff going on in this book about ducks.
Now, Ed, you say this unicorn is in the forest. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Maybe we'll just make that the next episode, is my wife and I trying to read stories in multiple voices.
Excellent.
It could only be what the people want. What we're going to talk about is work for hire comics, and you started off your career doing creator-owned stuff. I got to know you through Comics Experience and through the Comics Experience forums. You were putting out your own comics after taking some classes and been doing your own stuff for years. But I'm not quite sure the timetable. I should have looked back at my Paul Aller collection. The work for hire stuff that you moved into, you know, I'm sure there was some amount of roadmap to maybe figuring that out, and obviously people to talk to on the editorial side. But you're currently on G.I. Joe, mm-hmm. and that, you know, is a property that's known globally. Work for hire comes with a lot of different conditions, I'm sure, from folks on the license side, and especially, you know, with something like a comic book company in the mix, and then there's also another entity like a Hasbro, or, you know, fill in the blank, Marvel. You're working for an editor and Marvel, so that is essentially working for hire for the company that holds the intellectual property of Spider-Man or whatever the comic is. So I guess, I don't know if you recall you're getting started, but, you know, in general, looking at the work for hire stuff you've done, are there just some basic things that you now approach a work for hire pitch with?
That's a good question. I probably should have been prepared to answer questions on this podcast, shouldn't I have?
We can keep doing Carson's.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, usually with work for hire, like, I think that people kind of have this this misconception that it's a lot more wide open than it is, if they're just like, hey, you know, pitch us a Spider-Man story or pitch us a Ninja Turtle story, whereas usually there are like much more restrictions on it than that. The way I approach it is basically just try to do something that's interesting and surprising within the framework that they give me, and also that that is true to the spirit of the property, tonally and in terms of the voice of the characters, all that good stuff. And that can vary a lot depending on, like, you know, whether you're tying into an existing continuity, whether they're asking you to, like, revamp a new continuity, like what we did with G.I. Joe, that sort of thing. But it really starts with work for hire pitches. It really starts with the property and the voice of the property and making sure that you're in line with that and in line with the restrictions they're laying down. And then you try to see what you can do with that. So, yeah, and if you're not familiar with it, then, you know, you spend a lot of time, like, familiarizing yourself. I kind of had a lost weekend when I was pitching Power Rangers, my Power Rangers in Space story, of, like, watching the entire Power Rangers in Space season over the course of one weekend. And, you know, yeah, that was a trip. But, yeah.
Well, with all that in mind, you know, you're obviously familiarizing yourself with the property and talking to license holders, editors, folks that are coming to you for the pitch. Is something like this, because your background is obviously in writing and editing, as well as I know you're a great letterer as well.
Is something
like this, though, does it involve talking about an art team, or is that something that maybe just, I'm sure it depends on who you're doing what with, but do you come in with some ideas and include, hey, I think it could look like this and this person or these people, and take a look at their art and we can see if they're available?
Not generally. I think when you, like, for people who are further along in their careers and have a little more, like, pool, you know, who are, like, more, the, where the, when the dynamic shifts to the publishers wanting you rather than you like wanting the publisher, then I think you can get into some of that. But you know, when you first start out, you generally are just pitching the story. I usually don't know who is going to be on art before I pitch it. There are some exceptions to that. When I did my the Captain America issue that's coming out next month through Marvel, they did tell me up front that they were talking to Georges Gente, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. Sorry. so I knew that. But you know, usually you go in pitching without knowing who the art team is, and then like I don't. It's very rare that the editor will be like, who would you like on art for this? So, you know, who do you think would be good on art for this? Like with G.I. Joe, I did suggest Chris Avenhouse because we'd worked together many things before, and Bob, sure. And Bobby was familiar with him, and they took a look at him and thankfully got him on board. But that's a pretty big rarity.
Yeah, and Monstro Mechanica is where you can go find the last team up that I'm aware of from Aftershock Comics. Go pick that up. It's a great story, but boy, Chris's art is great.
It is amazing, yes.
And it was exciting to see that he was going to be the G.I. Joe artist. I think the series has been, you know, terrific to see his take and the direction that's gone. Yeah, it's funny because it seems like so much of when I was younger thinking about comics, and I think maybe the industry has shifted so much in the last, it feels like the industry shifts frequently, but the last couple of decades, it's not necessarily a goal to just do work for hire. Like, I want to get an exclusive contract. Not to say that people don't want to get exclusive contracts, or those are, you know, it's not good or bad. It sounds like they could be great. But I think people like the healthy balance of creator-owned and work for hire. And it's interesting to hear people think about, you're coming from doing your creator-owned thing, which is a different kind of hustle and a different kind of building a team and managing a team. And you're writing marketing copy, potentially you're doing it all, you know, you're making it happen. You're a small business in the business of publishing Paul Aller comics along with your collaborators and co-creators. And in something like work for hire, it's a team of people that are in place. And so when you're doing work for hire and you might not know all the collaborators and elements up in front of doing the pitch, do you come at it with a different approach for either just, I guess, the general concept or story?
Yeah, that definitely does make a difference. The ideal situation is that you at least know the artist before you start scripting. Sure. But yeah, when you... I don't know. I was going to say you have to be a little more general. But then as I was thinking about that, I don't actually do that. I think that I kind of just pitch whatever I normally would have pitched, and then hopefully the art team will fit what I'm doing. And you know, in most cases, the art isn't on yet when you're pitching, so the editor will make an effort to make sure that happens. But yeah, it definitely is different because when you're doing a creator-owned thing and you know who the artist is, then you can make it very specifically to that artist and to that collaboration and what you guys have discussed. Whereas work for hire, you do have to have, to a certain extent, you have to have it in mind that you don't know who is going to be working on this. But at the same time, I think you'd be doing yourself a disservice if you allowed that to like water down, for lack of a better word, your pitch, to make it like more broad and general. Like I don't think there is a story that could be effectively told by every artist out there. So, you know, if you're chasing that, you're kind of running after the wrong thing. And it's possible that you'll lose the pitch because of that. Because if the editor has an artist in mind and has a specific idea in mind of what they want it to be, and you pitch something that's different from that idea, then, you know, you might not get it. But that's part of the difficulty of doing work for hire, is that you never know exactly what you're pitching for. You know, if that makes sense. You know, like you're not inside the editor's brain, and you could turn in what would be a fantastic story, but it's not what they're looking for, and so that's the end of that.
Yeah, so threading multiple needles, but on the back of an elephant going down a mountain.
Yes.
Perfect.
And if you're in a bake-off, three or four other people are all doing the same thing.
Right. And bake off meaning multiple people have been asked to pitch on a project.
Yes.
Which is that super common? Is that the common way that things happen?
It's common early on. Yeah, it becomes less common as you get deeper into your career and editors become more familiar with you. But like I still, like G.I. Joe was a bake off, so I still do them
Sure.
now. But it's more and more often now that an editor will just say, "Hey, do you have some ideas for this?" So yeah.
Yeah, I know whenever we're asked to submit a budget for my production work, oftentimes it's up against other folks and it's not necessarily with creative. So it's, I guess it's not unheard of in creative services to have, multiple approaches to do stuff. And then obviously if you have a contract or in some cases, like you said, if they're just coming to you and they want it to be, hey, you're in, we just need to figure out what the pitch is. It's a number of different ways of making a thing go.
Yeah, and I know that like I've seen some of my peers on Twitter lately like saying things like let's just not do bake offs anymore. Like if someone wants to do a bake off, that's not respecting your time, so you shouldn't do it, blah, blah, blah. And I respect that point of view, and I can see where they're coming from, but at the same time, like I need the work, man. Like
Right.
that's great if you can do it, but if I wasn't willing to do bake offs, like I wouldn't be writing G.I. Joe. Samurai Jack was a bake off as well, so like yeah, that's sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
What are you gonna do? Yeah,
Yeah.
it's an interesting thing. Well, with yeah, it's because I try to think about, the point of the podcast in general is for people to share information and answer questions, tell anecdotes about how you get from A to B. And it seems like so much work for hire can only be experienced, no pun intended, when you're in it, as much as you can plan and prep for it. But until you actually go through the mechanics of, hey, I got asked to pitch on Power Rangers or Samurai Jack, and I learned how to work within the system, with editorial, with a licensor, and within these parameters of, these are the goals, but we can't use these characters because they're going to get a mini series that isn't announced yet, and
Right.
all the other stuff that goes into the swirl that, readers might not know about or might ever not ever know about. There's so much behind the scenes stuff that it's it seems to be that recurring theme of you got to be kind of just able to roll with things and be adaptable and
Oh, yeah.
be able to change based on, hey, you know what? We got a movie coming out next year, so now it's got to have this in it.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny what what must go on behind the scenes. Well, with I guess in general work for hire, I don't know if you have any advice on if people were doing their own comics, doing in the creator-owned world, or wanted to have a goal of, hey, I'd love to be able to get into a position to pitch on stuff. Does that follow the same route of advice as far as having work that you can meet with editors or talent scouts to start having your name just be in that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, what I did was I did a self-published book and sent it out to many, many, many different editors throughout the industry and kind of wormed my way in that way. But yeah, it is difficult getting your first gig because like not everyone can self-publish. I mean, that's a That can be a
Yeah.
very, very tricky and expensive thing, and I basically went into debt doing it, thinking that it would, pay off when my career launched, and that, didn't actually happen in as timely a manner as I thought, and I kind of fairly significantly damaged myself financially, and I'm still dealing with the fallout of that, of, spending too much money up front for a career that didn't take off as well as I thought it would. So I guess that's a pretty brutal response to your question. So I
That's
guess that's a tough one. Like, yeah,
it's
I mean breaking in is tough, and I think if you have a day job, hang on to that day job for dear life, and it's okay to go slowly. It's okay to like do just shorts, do like 5 pagers, 6 pagers. It's okay to like go to what cons are near you and you can afford, and slowly build up your relationships with editors. Because you know you gotta balance your own financial health and well-being against all those concerns. And like, you know, there are a lot of people out there who like do one or two anthology stories and then like, you know, boom, they're, you know, the gates are kind of swung open for them. But like,
yeah,
don't look at that and assume that's going to happen for you, because that's not the norm.
The exceptions
that takes an extraordinary level of extraordinary amount of luck. And like, that's not to say those people aren't talented, because of course they are, but like, they're talented and they had an extraordinary level of luck as well. You know, comics is not a pure meritocracy.
Right.
And the only people I've ever heard claim that it is are people who had really great connections and luck early on. I mean, just being honest. So yeah, well, it's brutal.
Yeah, I have not invested as much time and effort with comics as, in general, as I have with my production career, but I know multiple people, including my company at one point, where you're investing significant dollars on credit to buy a certain kind of camera or other piece of equipment with the idea of, now we're going to be able to get this kind of work.
Yeah.
And sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. You know, worked with people that have co-owned some gear, and then one of them gets out and the other person is left holding the bag going, now I also have to pay for this camera.
Wow.
on top of it. And that's $20,000 that I hadn't planned on spending. And then in conclusion, it could be cheaper to be a writer than to own a production company. But to your point, though, I think that's kind of one of the ongoing things that you do see every now and then crop up in social media and on Comics Experience, the forums for the workshop, is the discussion of the day job and people that have a day job and I want to do more comics and trying to get out of the day job and, you know, how do I move beyond it? And it is such a slow burn. It can be such a long, you know, it's the overnight success. It took me 10 years to get here. And
yeah.
I know Brian Bendis, reading interviews and listening to interviews early on with him, was one of those guys who was like, yeah, it was 10 years of slogging it out to get to where I, you know, I'm starting to get those shots. And you're like, oh, I never read anything by you before Powers. And then, oh yeah, Powers is great. And then all of a sudden he's Brian Bendis and writing everything. And
yeah,
it's just,
I'm hitting that 10-year mark now. My first self-published book came out about 10 years ago, and my first work-for-hire book came out about 8 years ago. I mean, to bring it back to work-for-hire, I've actually pitched for on properties that I've, like – I've never pitched on a property that I hated, but I've pitched on properties that I've, like, lightly made fun of in the past, you know? And I've definitely done some, like, you know, searches of my tweets to, like, delete some old knocks that I made. I can talk about this one because the project didn't actually happen, but I was hired to do a tie-in comic to a movie that was being produced by a very, very prominent Hollywood director and producer, whose work I had like kind of relentlessly crapped on a few times on Twitter. So I definitely did like a desperate search to delete when I got that offer. And so because of that, I'm a little like, I'm much more gun shy these days about giving my opinion on pop culture media than I used to be, because you never know. A, you never know what you're gonna be asked to pitch on. And then B, because a lot of comics people, especially now, also work in TV and movies and other media, you never know like if you're crapping on a show and then it turns out that like one of your friends is like one of the writers on it, you didn't know what, that kind of thing. So yeah,
that director and movie was Federico Fellini in 8 and a Half.
Mm-hmm.
That we could finally break that news. But I think that's good. That's just kind of good advice in general, depending on, you know, your tone and tenor and social media and what you're trying to do. It can be a little tricky. It can be a little, you don't necessarily want to slog off stuff that that somebody you know might be involved with. And that, you know, that's something I think about too, is sometimes I'll read comics from creators that I love, the artist and writer or one or the other, and it just doesn't connect with me with, for whatever reasons. Like, I am not this kind of fantasy person. It's not my bag, or it might be genre, it might be, maybe I don't connect to the art. But it's funny, even the stuff that you do love and the people that you do follow, when there are moments of like, well, I'm not going to read this any further. I'm done here.
Right.
I can't believe that. I've been reading their stuff for years, and it's,
yeah.
It's especially tricky to do reviews too, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I don't want to make it sound like I've just been like a raging a-hole on Twitter. But you know, like I, like lighthearted jabs at things. I don't know. Like one I remember specifically is like Stranger Things. I made a lot of jokes about Stranger Things, which I didn't care for and didn't connect with me early on. Like, I remember one tweet that I made said, like, you know, I just watched the first couple episodes of Stranger Things, and yeah, if you love E.T. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind, then you should definitely just go back and watch those, rewatch those instead. So just that kind of thing, that, like, you know, not like, I don't consider that being an a-hole. I consider that like making a joke about a TV show that didn't connect with me, but like, I'm not going to be pitching on the Stranger Things comic if they were to see that, you know what I mean? So that's the kind of thing that like you just want to watch yourself a little bit.
Yep. That all makes sense. And yeah. I imagine in some cases too, maybe folks are too far the other end where you're too fanish over something and it might not have the same kind of, look there that you necessarily want as far as editors go. Although I know that there's some folks that have gotten, positions from doing fan art or fan fiction, so it's...
Yeah, I was gonna say that's true. I do think that's a little better. So yeah, I mean coming from a different background than a lot of comics writers, like I don't have a lot of the same pop culture background as other people, and I don't think that's a fault. Like there does seem to be this idea that like the best person to write on XYZ property is someone who's been a fan of XYZ property like since they were five years old, and I don't necessarily I started reading comics when I was 28, so that's, you know, kind of gives me a different perspective on it. So I remember like I jokingly said something about like, you know, I early on in my career I said something about how, you know, I've only been a fan of comics for a couple years, so you know, I hope all these people who have been reading them since they were 6 years old don't mind if I try to pitch on them too, or you know, is that okay, like that kind of thing. And one of the responses I got was, I think it's fine, from a professional comics writer, was like, I think it's fine as long as you treat them with the proper reverence. And I was like, reverence?
Oh boy.
Okay, reverence. I mean, come on, it's Spider-Man.
Oh, okay, had you picked anybody else, I mean, now this just feels personal. This all ties back to my daughter and not her not liking Spider-Man as much as she likes Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable.
Many, many heated debates happen around our dinner table. I see. Yeah, it's usually related to Wonder Woman.
And, you know, the word I would use instead of reverence is respect.
Sure.
I think you need to have respect for the core of the property, what people love about the property. But yeah, and that might be what that person meant as well. But just that word reverence kind of made me go, wow. Okay.
Reverence does not sound like the word necessarily to have used. But I think that's something that we have come back to a few times just over the course of conversations for the podcast, is you need to understand the property. But also, you know, at the end of the day, it's a job, and it might not be the version of the thing that you read as a kid because of all the other reasons outlined. The company might be going in a different direction, or it's...
Yeah.
So just from the comics experience end of things, Andy Schmidt was on recently talking about C2E2. He's going to be at C2E2 with Comics Experience. If you're listening to this before the weekend, the 27th of February through March 1st, you can go find Andy at the SourcePoint press booth, and you can also find a couple panels happening. So comicsexperience.com has all your info there. Paul is also part of the publishing program at Comics Experience, which the window is closing. So I don't know how relevant that is, but that's something that you guys have had open since February, is the chance for folks within the forums to be able to pitch their comics to be published through SourcePoint.
Yep. Yeah, until February 29th at midnight. I'm going to go ahead and make an editorial judgment and say midnight local time. So
midnight
time. I'll let you slide in if you're in Asia.
If you're West Coast.
Yeah.
Well, that I know that the submissions do open up from time to time. So if that's something you're curious about, go to comicsexperience.com as well. And Paul, you're on Twitter at Paul Aller.
Yep.
Any other places folks should go to check out?
No. I mean, if you want to see pictures of my dog, you can check out my Instagram, but I don't do much comics promotion there.
Yeah, that is a good feed, though, if you do want dog pictures.
Yes.
You could do much worse than than wiener dog pictures.
That's paul.aller, yeah. And the G.I. Joe trade is available for pre-order now. It collects issues 1 through 6 and comes out in July. So check that out, G.I. Joe Volume 1, World on Fire. And G.I. Joe issues 1 through 5 are on the stands. Captain America is coming out next month. Marvel Avengers : Captain America out on March 18th.
Thanks for doing this, Paul. And thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, keep making comics.